Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday morning, 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. Shana Falana performing music for us tonight and going to be performing at the Colony in Woodstock, New York tonight at 8 o'clock. ColonyWoodstock.com. We'll be hearing Shana Falana this morning.
That was Shana Falana?
That was Shana Falana.
Good Shana Falana. Right
there. That was spacey. I like it.
It's good. So we'll be hearing that throughout the morning. All right. Let me introduce everybody. It's good to have the group assembled. Judy Patrick is with us, VP of Editorial Development for the New York Press Association, longtime editor of the Daily Gazette. Good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Wonderful to have you here. Thank you very much. Siena College Economics Professor Aaron Pasitti joins us. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. I'm happy that I was introduced before the DA. makes me feel good.
And now, Albany County District Attorney David Soares. Good morning, David.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. Good to have you here.
David had a major victory this week. The governor backed off on some of his efforts to control the state's DAs.
I don't know if by backing off you mean he signed the Prosecutorial Conduct Commission bill.
That's what I meant.
But
it's not what it was once designed to be.
Oh, it's still so terribly, terribly flawed.
Still a stinker.
It's terrible, and we'll be back in court.
Cool.
Yeah. All right.
And you're the head man, and everybody knows it. You know, your name is in every story.
That's not always necessarily a good thing.
So not a victory.
So
you're just crying on the inside, because outside you look great.
I'm not crying, because you know what?
Great song, by the way.
The politics of our state right now are chaotic, and to me the only place where we can find reason and logic will be in a courtroom, and so that's where we're looking forward to be.
Well, good luck with that. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, sir. Welcome back. Nice to have you.
Well, thank you. I had a rough 2 days. I was doing battle with the bureaucracy at National Public Radio.
Oh, how are they today? How are they doing?
They were awful. Yeah. They were god-awful. They really want to...
So you're crying on the inside and the outside.
Yeah, they want to steal every sou we have. They just can't get enough. So I had to go, and like Lochinvar coming out of the West... I had to do battle with them, and I think we won.
Good. Excellent. Well, we look forward to hearing.
I'm not talking about – somebody wrote to me and said, why don't you like the people who are doing a good job on the Ten Poles Morning Edition and, all things considered? And I said, oh, I love those people. It's the guys in the back rooms who try instead of going out and finding the money they need to run their organization, they come and try to get it from us.
Well –
and we give them almost $1 million.
Victory.
Yeah.
Or we'll see.
We'll
right?
see.
Yeah, okay.
We'll see.
All right. Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome. You are welcome to join us and tell us what you think. Simply write panel@wamc.org. And if you could stick to our topics, that would be even better. panel@wamc.org. Let us go to what is being called the Mueller mystery. It's a good way of talking once again about the Mueller report, but also the Washington Post article that is written by four reporters about this question, the mystery being, why did Donald Trump get away with not having to do an interview with a special prosecutor or having a subpoena fight? So this is the mystery. It was March 2018, nearly 10 months into the Russia investigation, when Special Counsel Robert Mueller, a man of few words, raised the stakes dramatically in a meeting with President Trump's lawyers. If the president did not sit down voluntarily for an interview, he could face a subpoena. In the months that followed, Mueller never explicitly threatened to issue a subpoena as his office pursued a presidential interview, a sit-down for which the special counsel was pushing as late as December. But with that prospect hanging over them, Trump's legal advisors conducted a quiet, multi-pronged pressure campaign to avert such an action and keep the president from coming face-to-face with federal investigators, fearful that he would...
get into a perjury trap.
Perjure himself, exactly. Yeah. One point last summer when a well in talks had the president's attorneys worried that Mueller was seriously contemplating a subpoena, White House lawyer Emmett Flood wrote a memo laying out the legal arguments for protecting the president's executive privilege. He sent the documents to Mueller's office and to the deputy for top Justice Department official Rod Rosenstein, who oversaw the probe, according to two people familiar with Flood's outreach. I'm going to go to David first as far as the court machinations here, but how does the President of the United States avoid talking to the special prosecutor?
Well, first of all, as a prosecutor leading this investigation, Bob Mueller has to consider so many things. First and foremost is, do you want to get into the thicket of collateral proceedings, endless collateral proceedings?
Which means?
Well, for example, you're talking about the President of the United States. You're talking about the President who has executive privilege. And so asking the President for an interview isn't something as simple as asking any other witness for an interview, because most witnesses do not have executive privilege. And so for Bob Mueller, and he would have to explain, and we'd have to actually read his reports in making those determinations. But for him, it's a matter of deciding whether or not you're going to engage in this process of fighting, litigating a lot of different collateral proceedings to determine whether or not this person is going to give you information. And then you have to decide whether or not there's any value to the information that this person would have provided for you in the first place. And that's a consideration. In other words, they could have been well into their investigations and could have been at a place where they're looking at this and saying, do we really need to hear from him, because we don't really have enough information to indicate that there was any conspiracy here with Russia. If they're looking at that aspect of the case and they're realizing that there's really not there, then there really isn't much to be gained from having him personally sit down and speak with you.
This is going to sound like a flip question, but I mean it as a serious question. Yeah. But wouldn't it just be fun to see him perjure himself?
Well, it would be fun to see him perjure himself, but it, you know, if you're a person who I suspect is a serious, you know, prosecutor like Mr. Mueller and this team that they had, I mean, they understand that they're on the clock.
Right.
Are you going to spend the next, you know, year in litigation just to get testimony from a person who isn't going to be forthright and probably give you what you need in order to make your case?
And then, David, get to the Supreme Court, which is now firmly in the pocket of the president.
Exactly. And we talk, you know, again, I've been saying this from every time I'm here. Everyone celebrated the blue wave, but there's a red wave in our judiciary, and that's an effect that we're going to be feeling for a long time to come. And so if you're the prosecutor who's conducting this investigation and you're contemplating interviewing the President of the United States, the first two things you got to consider is, what could we possibly be getting? What could we be learning from this interview? And second of all, if he decides to exert executive privilege, which the law is so unclear about executive privilege, do we really want to spend all of this energy and time?
And yet,
litigating?
I want to go back to what Joe said in introducing this topic, calling it, you know, the mystery.
The Mueller mystery.
The Mueller mystery. When the Washington Post uses the Mueller mystery, there's a little hint as to what they're thinking there. And the question, which nobody wants to bring up, is, did Mueller take a fall?
I don't think Mueller took a fall. As a matter of fact, what I've witnessed, so let's go back to what you started talking about earlier, right? You said the issue with NPR. To me, the most important fight that we have today, 2019, is our media, right?
Right.
We need to be getting our information from honest brokers and honest sources, right?
Yes. And it's always under attack.
And so, to me, I'm stunned. Last Friday, we hear that this report has been issued, and it's on the desk of in the Department of Justice. We haven't seen it. We've seen four pages from perhaps a documents. It's a report that stems into thousands of pages. And without a bit of information, we have seen media on every side just absolutely engage in utter speculation with no facts. Did Mueller take a dive? I've seen interpretations of the law this week that I've just had to scratch my head. Barr's interpretation of this investigation is a head scratcher. And so we have months.
Not for me, it isn't.
Yes. I mean, the easy answer is,
The guy gets up before the Senate and he says, we're going to give the American people what they want. We're going to give them the information. And now he shows what a total hypocrite he is.
I believe that. Now, the question that I have about the Mueller investigation, the question that I have is, did he not, in putting together his report, did he not also take into consideration the various baskets that the information was going to go in. For example, you have materials that were obtained as a result of a subpoena that you cannot share with anyone because it's a grand jury subpoena. Then you have the privileged information, the basket of privileges that you could say, okay, well, we can't disclose a lot of this information because it's privileged information. Then you have...
Why don't you define privilege for everybody?
And well, you know, there are certain privileges, for example, the executive privilege. I'm sure that they were able to obtain a lot of documents that before they can publicize, they would have to give the executive the opportunity to exert privilege. And that's the second basket. And then the third basket is all of the information that you can, in fact, share with everyone, right? So with Congress, let's talk about the congressional oversight. With Congress would certainly have the right to materials that were, in fact, you know, subpoenaed because they have oversight. And so there, but you have to carefully tailor what it is that you'd be able to share with Congress. Not every congressional member has the ability and top secret clearance to be able to view those things, but some in fact do. And many of the oversight committees, those people do. We've seen it happen during the Mueller investigation when Nunez wanted to see privileged information. So they made that information available under very limited circumstances. And so, you know, that's the kind of material that that Congress would have to be viewing at this point. My question is whether or not Mueller, in authoring his report, considered all of those issues so that there wouldn't be too much time between when he finishes his report and when that report would get into the public setting. Because right now, Barr is using that excuse to hold on to these reports. And I would think that Mueller would have considered all of these things. And what he's doing is basically holding on to this information, creating the excuse that it's going to take a long time to sift through. Well, if that was the case, how then did you come up with a four-page executive summary over the weekend, right? So I do believe when he says, look, we have a lot to go through, to sift through, to make sure that we can, in fact, publicize as you know information without compromising national security and violating you know the privileges. I believe that. What I don't believe is that he could have gone through all of those things
in 24 hours,
conducted his summary, and now it just appears to me that we're using this excuse to give the president a head start in framing the issue.
Well, and how much, and to go back 3 weeks prior to that, where Mueller came and said that he would not be able to prove obstruction, or he wasn't going to come to a conclusion on obstruction, don't you think that gave them a window of time to work on what they were going to do?
I absolutely believe that. Now, I want to, if I can, and I don't want to dominate the conversation here, but I just want to give
you... But you are an expert, so go ahead.
I just want to give you like a little example of why this is the conclusions reached by Barr was so outrageous. Let's say, for example, you have a guy standing at the corner, and this guy is saying, you know, the police stink, and he's yelling at the police. And all of a sudden, the police come, and they arrest him, right? Usually what we see in the practice is you have a charge for disorderly conduct, and then you have another charge for resisting arrest, right? The resisting arrest charge is really dependent on the validity of a lawful arrest. So a person standing on the corner shouting is a person who's expressing his First Amendment rights. He can say, police stink. That's his First Amendment right. So the arrest for the disorderly conduct would be unlawful. And so because the underlying charge is unlawful, then it's impossible to make a lawful arrest that a person can resist. I just want to make sure that we're clear there. In this particular instance, because Mueller's charge is two, right, he has to determine whether or not there was a conspiracy with the Russians to undermine the election. And second of all, whether or not there was an obstruction in the investigation of that case. Those two things are not related. So it is possible to achieve the goal of saying, okay, there is no criminal conspiracy. But then the other issue of whether or not there was a resistance, an intentional effort to undermine the investigation, that's a separate question altogether. And my belief is that Mr. Mueller, in laying out all of this evidence, intended to have Congress ultimately reach the conclusion and not the attorney general who's conflicted from making that decision.
But then the question is, does it ever get to the American people? You know, David, on the Media Project, Judy and I and a bunch of people today were talking about the idea that for the first time in the governor's budget bill, there is a prohibition about telling people who got arrested and putting their mugshots up and the rest of it. Isn't that right, Judy?
Exactly.
Yeah. And while they may not, it may be a little bit non sequitorial to raise that, the war on the press is not.
No, the war on press is—it's manifesting in a variety of ways, every single day. And you know, the idea that a person is arrested. First of all, a person is arrested. That person is charged. There's probable cause to determine that a crime was committed, and that's the individual that committed that crime. Our courts are open forums. Any person anywhere can walk into a courtroom and watch its proceeding. That's the fundamental basis of the freedoms that we have in a democratic society, is that our government has to be transparent. And I think that any time you start to chip away at that transparency, we are heading in a terrible direction. And the idea that you're doing it in the name of protecting some people, that's the slippery slope that I think advocates like yourselves have to continue to fight and defend.
This wasn't a chip away. This was a big chunk away from the public's right to know. Yeah. This is something that will make our criminal justice system secretive, and that's not something anyone in America should want, or anyone in New York State should want.
I think what is happening right now in our state, in our country, is we see an injustice, and there's passion that surrounds advocacy around an injustice, and in the effort to correct the injustice, I find that more often than not, you're getting into some very unconstitutional issues, the solutions that are being presented.
And why wouldn't the characters in the state legislature want a law that said if they get arrested, which they do on some regularity?
We'll never know.
All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We will be right back after this short break. I know what you It's Shauna Falana performing at the Colony in Woodstock tonight, 8 o'clock, colonywoodstock.com. Welcome back to the roundtable. Alan Chartok, Judy Patrick, Aaron Pacitti, and David Soares. You had a question right before we went to break.
I have a question for David about the subpoena. So assuming that the subpoena went through without any legal challenges, would Mueller have learned anything new that he did not already know with other interviews and other document reviews? Like, was there any advantage to subpoenaing the president?
I think that and I'm just speculating here because I too am interested in reading his report, but I think that they had already had all the information that they needed in order to make a determination on both counts without having to thrust their entire focus and energies into the battling of subpoenas for purposes of overcoming executive privilege.
Could there be like an optics issue with forcing the subpoena on the president in terms of confirming the fact that this was a Trump witch hunt, that if, you know, the Mueller spent a year litigating the subpoena in court, then it all of a sudden it lends credibility to this is a witch hunt. Why are they pursuing this so hard? The White House gave, you know, 1 million-plus pages of documents.
I think you're absolutely right, because if Mueller had already decided, based upon the investigation, that there's really no proof of a conspiracy with a foreign government, then the idea that he would spend the energy in litigation only to have the fruits of that litigation, you know, not really change that, then you're really, you know, lending credence to the messaging that this particular person and all of his cronies have engaged in over the course of the last 2 years.
So the one guy who seems to be questioning whether that the fact is it true that really there was no collusion is Adam Schiff, and you have, you know, the walls crumbling down, calling for his ouster.
I want to just say this, and I want to be 1,000% clear. You have a brilliant branding marketer who happens to also be the most outrageous person ever to occupy the White House, who seized on the word collusion and has drilled that word into the psyche of the American press, who's in turn continued to impound that word into the brains of us, right? We're talking about conspiracy. A criminal conspiracy requires that every single person who's involved in that conspiracy act in concert in order to achieve a goal. In this instance, what you had were Batman and the Joker. Remember all the henchmen and the old Batman? What you had was Donald Trump and all of his costumed henchmen who were not necessarily, you know, planning and engaging in any kind of, you know, nefarious group think and plan. They were all operating as independent agents. But it doesn't mean that they didn't collude. It means that that you cannot hold them criminally liable for conspiracy, but it doesn't mean that they didn't collude. And that's what Adam Schiff is trying to make this, is creating this distinction. They all colluded to achieve the victory that Donald Trump achieved. Whether or not, you know, they were acting in concert and they were criminally, you know, engaging in behavior in order to achieve a criminal purpose, that's a different question. But we don't have a report. We haven't seen it. We haven't read it to see where, you know, those connections or where those elements were not met for that purpose.
We do have a lot of letters. Alan, we'll go to those and we'll find out what's on people's minds this morning.
Okay, here we go. Mike says, Elise Stefanik, happy Friday. Panel, what are your thoughts on Elise Stefanik signing the letter with her fellow Republicans asking Adam Schiff to step down as chairperson of the House Select Committee on Intelligence? I am disgusted and saddened that she would be involved in such a partisan public relations move. Thanks for your thoughts, Mike. I'll go first, as is my privilege, and just say to you, you know, there's two terms. I've explained this before. One of them is you're in the tank. Your leadership says to you, you got to vote with us. And the other is you're off the hook. Well, this time she was in the tank. She was safely elected. She's not a marginal. And they say, hey, we're really going to go after this guy with everything we got. And you are in the tank and you got to do what we say. That's not good.
Sounds like a witch hunt.
I like it.
But in the opposite direction.
That's why we have you on the program.
I think she signed her own political death warrant.
Really?
I do.
How do you figure?
First of all, I don't think there are very few occasions that you can actually turn on your television, watch, you know, those proceedings and walk away feeling like something has just happened to shake our country at our foundation. That particular speech by Adam Schiff was so remarkable.
It's the best thing I've seen for a long time.
And because obfuscation has been the purpose of both Fox News and this administration and all of their allies, and to have someone in 5 minutes bring us all back to the reason why this whole thing started and why we're continuing to do these hearings, to me was phenomenal. And for her to be on the receiving end of that, I just think that this follows her for the rest of her career.
I don't know. You know, David, I hope you're right. But on the other hand, there's another way of looking at this. No matter what happens, when you take a look at the polling on the Republican support for this president, it doesn't falter. It doesn't falter no matter how much he gets up there and acts like you-know-who from 1932. It doesn't. It's just how much it's like Nuremberg and the rest of it. Those people stick with him. And she's got to know that.
Yeah, they may stick with him on general issues, but this call for Schiff to resign seems frivolous.
Well, I think it's frantic, obviously. They know what they've got there. He's carrying the sword and he's doing it well. Anyway, next letter. Rich says, perhaps Mueller doesn't come to a conclusion because Mueller knew Trump obstructed justice to prevent the discovery of his financial woes. These investigations were transferred to the Southern District of New York, and that's from Rich. That's a very good point about, you know, how, look, Mueller worked for them. Let's face it. In the end, they were over him. So yeah. By handing stuff off, as you know this, David, is better than any of us, to the Southern District, assuming the Southern District can remain an honest broker, was a brilliant move.
Well, you know, one of the things that I woke up with on Monday, hearing all of the disappointment about the results of the Mueller report, I was scratching my head saying, have you been paying attention for the last 2 years? The Kent Star, you know, was given such broad jurisdiction that he began his investigating Whitewater and various federal loans, and ended on the President of the United States lying about
sex,
right? So if Bob Mueller was given the same mandate as opposed to the limitations that his mandate, you know, required, yeah. right, then at the end of the day, you know, Robert Mueller's investigation within 2 years netted a total of 34 indictments or guilty pleas, 26 Russian nationals, 3 Russian companies, 1 California man, 1 London lawyer, and 6 Trump advisors, in addition to various investigations into the – if you want to include – the Southern District would not be a player in this. It would be Bob Mueller's case. The same thing with – some of the cases involving the Attorney General. If you recall, Bob Mueller early on was reaching out to various independent organizations and making these referrals. If Bob Mueller was given the same latitude in terms of jurisdiction as Ken Starr was.
But he wasn't.
But he was not. My point is, his focus was on two issues. He investigated those two issues, referred a ton of other cases for investigation, and he's arrived at the conclusion for the very two issues. Had it been Ken Starr, had he had the same jurisdiction, then all of these cases would come under his umbrella and a result of his work.
You know, one of the things we discussed on the Media Project, again, Judy sitting here, you know, was the idea that the American people, a significant part of them, were so disappointed in the Mueller verdict that they stopped watching Rachel Maddow. And then they stopped watching CNN, so that the numbers have gone down. So to me, this proves that the president's efforts to vilify Schiff and shift burden on all of this is working.
Well, it has worked. I will say this. It is so irresponsible for any person who refers to themselves as a journalist to conduct any kind of interview with this president. And when this president, you know, contends that he's been absolved from any liability, that he's been completely absolved from you know, these allegations, and they don't push back, then you are no longer a journalist. To allow for this person to message, you know, these conclusions is just, it is an embarrassment.
So Dr. Michael wants to know, does D.A. Soares believe that the Fifth Circuit will strike down the ACA in its entirety?
This, I don't believe that they will. I certainly don't envy any jurist right now who is being presented with these issues, having to make a decision for the health care of millions and millions of Americans.
Yeah, that's a risky proposition because Republicans don't have an alternative plan in place. And they never had an alternative plan. Like, you know, the Affordable Care Act came out of a Heritage Foundation policy brief back in the 1990s as an alternative to Hillary Clinton's proposed health care reform. So it is a Republican plan. It's a very conservative market-based plan. So how Republicans would replace that with something arguably more conservative is just mind-boggling. So what they're just planning to do is take it away from people. And that's a really risky strategy with you know, 2020 elections coming up.
But Aaron, don't you see this as the same thing as the wall? The issue is more important than doing it to him. In other words, he makes the noises. He says, "I want to get rid of it, and I want to do all of that stuff." But the support from the base comes from the attack.
He's such a neophyte.
I think the support from the base might start dwindling if people see their health care being taken away from them and all of a sudden they can't get insurance or their premiums are skyrocketing.
Hope you're right.
But in New York Times, I think it's New York Times reporting from the internal discussions of this indicate that it, politics was the motivating reason for this. It was not the practical implications.
Absolutely.
At all.
Yeah. It wasn't the practical implications, but you know, to understand this president is to also understand that he only cares about his politics. He doesn't care about the politics of Mitch McConnell.
That's right.
Or any of the senators or any of the remaining Republican representatives. This is not an issue that anyone wanted to take on because it spells calamity for remaining, you know, for controlling the Senate and the dwindling numbers within the House.
Sure. Letters. Well, actually, let's take a break. We'll come back and we'll
do
the letters.
That's what I thought.
Excellent. We'll take a break and then we'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Back to the letters.
Okay, Joe. And we heard from Paul, who said, great show today. Good morning, panel. Just want to say a great discussion this morning. So rare these days, the logical discussion of issues that don't border on hysteria. I have stopped watching cable news. Alan, good job pushing back on the NPR fees. And that's from Paul of the Berkshire Health Systems. And Joel says, Mueller report. Good morning. We will see the Mueller report. And then it says here, parenthesis, pregnant pause. On the same day, we see Trump's tax returns. Follow the money, Joel from Blooming Grove. And Linda says, David Soares. I love David Soares and the ways he explains things so clearly. I love the whole panel, actually. And that's from Linda. Isn't that nice? And we heard from Mike in High Falls. Pardon me. Good morning, he says. I can believe that Trump was an unwitting participant in Russia's scheme to distort our democracy. He's the perfect rube to do so. I also can't help to think what Barr omitted from his synopsis is all the financial ties Trump has with Russia, which I would assume would be considered a crime, but boy, the optics would be bad. Mike from High Falls again. And Charlie says, collusion. Love your show. Don't we have firm evidence that Paul Manafort went to Spain to meet a Russian official and gave him sophisticated polling data? How can this not be seen as an attempt to influence our election? That's Charlie from Wilbraham, where everybody owns a pig. Rich says, obstruction of justice. Perhaps Mueller doesn't come to a conclusion because Mueller knew Trump obstructed justice to prevent the discovery of his financial woes. These investigations were transferred to the Southern District of New York. That's from Rich in Amherst. Everybody in Amherst listens to this station. And Jimmy says, frustrated. If we don't seek the truth because it is complex, we might as well give up. Propaganda itself is complex. Manipulating truths, says Jimmy, I'm so sorry. And then we heard from Denise, who says, Puerto Rico. Good morning, panel. I wish journalists and reporters would not allow Trump's lies to go unchallenged. Yesterday, he stated that he sent $91 billion to Puerto Rico. And then I've taken better care of Puerto Rico than any man ever. This is so far from the truth. PR received less funds. Puerto Rico received less funds from Texas and Florida. And even authorized funds have been withheld. And that's from Denise and Sorgates. And Bob says, honest brokers in the media. Can David Soares please indicate some honest brokers in the media? Examples. Our household likes the round table, Chris Churchill, Harry Melber, and Dahlia Litwick. But we worry about confirmation bias. How can we determine what makes an honest broker in the media?
Sometimes it's all. Sometimes it's great to turn on the BBC or to just listen to an economist podcast from a source that exists outside of our own country. It's interesting to get the perspective of those people that are on the outside looking in.
What do you think, Judy?
Yeah, I think trying to find there's no such thing as totally unbiased news, but I always encourage people to read and listen to a range of viewpoints, and you have to come to your own conclusion. You also have to read carefully. We talked in the Media Project this week about how the original reaction to the Barr letter was that there was no collusion. Well, if you actually read the letter very carefully, that's not exactly what it was saying, but that's what all the headlines were saying. So even some of the big papers get it wrong occasionally. Keeping your mind open, being aware of what other people are writing, and then finding sources that you do trust over time. I think if time after time someone writes a story that you find is real and true, go to that source again and again, although be mindful that everybody makes mistakes once in a while.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Steve says, more collusion. Great show. Don't for a second believe there aren't shenanigans going on between the White House, the new Attorney General, and Mueller's crew. Let's think about this. 300-page report taking 22 months and $25 million to produce, submitted on a Friday, reviewed and summarized by the new Attorney General in about 24 hours, and 4 pages revealed on Sunday, and no testimony from the president himself, question mark. I want to know, who is going to investigate the possible collusion in the making, delivery, and summary of this report? Thoughts? Thanks, Steve. Well, we'll let it speak for
itself. I think what's going to happen in the not-too-distant future, probably within this week or the following week, is that should Barr maintain his current posture and obfuscation, you're going to have some interesting leaks to the media from people with direct knowledge of what happened in terms of that investigation and the submission of that report. I cannot imagine that good, conscientious people would ever allow for their hard work to go trampled upon by people who are in the business of obfuscation and lies.
Well, let me push back on that a little bit. First of all, they did a pretty damn good job of not letting any leaks out during the whole procedure here. However, I do think that we did get one piece of information that somebody told them, which was that the length of the report, the 300 pages. We didn't know that. So somebody let that out. And I'm sure they're working on that somebody to try to figure out what else they can get.
And it's also not 300 pages. I can tell you that a lawyer can do 300 pages in a minute. It's going to be, well into the thousands of pages because all of the
your lunch order is 300 pages.
The appendix, and all of the different attachments to, a final report. You've subpoenaed banks from all over the world. You've subpoenaed, records from all over. Those things are going to be attached. So this idea that a 300-page report was submitted is just absurd to me.
And Mueller seems like a single space kind of guy to me, not a double space kind of guy.
Good point.
Yeah. Well, the appendix in the human body is supposed to be worthless.
This one might be valuable.
But not in this case.
Yes.
Yeah. And Mark says, Barr's summary quotes Mueller as saying there was no collusion between Trump and his associates and the Russian government. Does that leave open the possibility of collusion between Trump and his associates with others, including possibly Russian oligarchs? Did Mueller look into if Russia has compromising information on Trump or his associates? In my opinion, and these are in capital letters, we need to know why Mueller did not decide the issue of obstruction and who he thought should decide the issue. We can postulate all we want, but only Mueller knows, and he owes it to us to share his reasoning, and that's Mark from Clifton Park.
I think we can speculate that.
Nice use of postulate, by the way. Go ahead.
I think there is evidence of obstruction. That's the reason why that the special prosecutor did not clear, this president of the allegations of obstruction. I think what he was contemplating was, is there enough evidence here to indict? And we have a policy in the Department of Justice of not indicting sitting presidents. And so, I'm going to present the findings. We can emphatically say there's no criminal conspiracy, but I'm going to present the findings, and hopefully Congress, whose job it is to provide oversight and be the check, they can decide what they're going to do.
I'm still very upset by this, by the premise, by the gag, Johnny Carson. The premise here is that a sitting president cannot be indicted. But you take it to its logical extremes, as I've said 1,000 times. And if the president does what he said he could do, which is to shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue, you're telling me you couldn't indict that president for murdering somebody?
There is a distinction between the Department of Justice establishing a policy and the crimes that are in violation of our state and our federal constitution. So this idea that you cannot indict a sitting president, we shouldn't be lost in the fact that that's just a policy from the Department of Justice. That is not a law.
And it's one person who theoretically is above the law. Let's accept the fact that, you know, it's not law, but it's, you know, obit edict or whatever. Still, it's incredible that you accept this very basic premise that one person is above the law in this country.
And I think that if you're, for example, if the Southern District, you know, were to have, you know, charges that certainly were indictable, I doubt that they would take a pass. I doubt that my colleague in Manhattan, if my colleague in Manhattan found that there would be, you know, charges that legitimately, ethically, you could present to a grand jury, I doubt that
you're talking about Cy Vance,
yes,
though, but he is not a federal official, right?
He's not a federal official. No, but what my point is, there is no law that suggests that a president cannot be indicted and prosecuted. There is a policy in the Department of Justice that seems to articulate, you know, that bad policy.
Yep.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the economy. We'll have Aaron give us a State of the Trump Economy report. We will talk about Betsy DeVos's plan to take away money to the Special Olympics, which the president has now turned. And we'll even talk about the banning of plastic bags in New York State.
Do we get to have a little Falana coming back?
Yeah, we're going to have a little Falana coming back. Shauna Falana. We'll be here. All right. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We'll do the letters quick, and then we'll go to Aaron on the economy, and then we'll move on to other stuff.
John said, where can we find hope? Given the 100 words in Barr's letter and 300 pages yet to be seen by Congress and or the public, do you believe there's any hope for a Trump takedown of some type of turning of his fascist tide? Please send us a glimmer of hope in this mysterious time. Thank you. I do. I believe things are going to change.
Here's a little bit of hope. If Barr's intention, right, was to create a narrative in four pages, right, the fact that he included that solid line in there that talks about him not being completely absolved from any responsibility, I forget the exact words that he used, that had to then be such a focal point of that report that it was almost unavoidable to include it in that letter.
Yes, I agree with you.
Yeah. All right, we'll take that.
And the hope is also we have elections every 4 years for president. This 2020 is just around the corner.
Well, if you read the polls right now, Trump is a goner. However,
that's what the polls said in 2016.
Exactly right. That was the however.
Oh, sorry.
Peter says, loyalty from the Attorney General. It's hard to believe that Barr would be objective and fair about summarizing or replacing the Mueller report when the reason he was appointed to his position is probably was because he would be more loyal to Trump than Jeff Sessions. So Congress and the public will probably never know the whole story. I think historians do a pretty good job of figuring all of this out, and sooner or later we are going to know the whole story. Jennifer says, there's a signpost up ahead. Panel, you have now entered the no evidence, mean evidence conspiracy zone. So after 2 years of Allen claiming on an almost daily basis that he knew Trump was going to fire Mueller, you now have to believe that Mueller took a long dive, that Trump must be lying, and that once you have the actual report, you will find that evidence in capital letters that will bring Trump down. Stop. Just stop, says Jennifer. Okay. You say we read it. That's what we do here, you know.
I don't know what Jennifer, what did she mean?
What do you mean?
I don't know what Jennifer just said there.
Well, she said that I had said that Trump, in a corner, would have to fire Mueller. And maybe that's one of the reasons that we got what we got from Mueller, that he didn't go further. I don't know. Williams says, low bar. AG Barr successfully swept the Iran-Contra under the rug 25 years ago. Trump chose the right henchman in Barr, and that's from Williams. And Bob said, good morning, panel. On last night's MSNBC show, Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell, when discussing the speech given by Adam Schiff, he was reminded of the Army McCarthy hearings. He thinks Representative Schiff's speech will go down in history equal to the statement during the McCarthy hearings. Have you no sense of decency? And that's Bob from Holyoke. And let me just say, I came home yesterday from my long days of battle, and Roselle looked at me and said, that Schiff speech was the best speech I have heard all year, whatever it's worth. So you can all go online and find it. Ted says, is the Southern District independent? Panel, can you ask David, since the Southern District is under Barr, wouldn't he suppress any findings similar to the Mueller report? And you know, I had that same question.
That organization is independent. It is about as independent can be. Have a lot of confidence in our colleagues in the Southern District.
All right. President Trump is getting exactly what he wants in the economy, but it may not last. While Mr. Trump points with pride to last year's economic growth and promises even faster growth to come, there are signs that his most dependable talking point is eroding. On Thursday, the Commerce Department issued a downward revision of its estimates for economic growth in the fourth quarter, pushing one measure of the full year's growth down as well. Forecasters outside the White House, including officials at the Fed, expect growth to slow even more this year. Economic data suggests that slowdown is already underway in the first quarter.
Okay. So
go, Aaron.
There's a lot going on. So I want to preface this with, there's no real red flag out there in terms of any economic indicators or international events that is going to send the economy into a recession. So I think an appropriate metaphor here is imagine a car that's the economy. So when it's moving forward, it's growing. When it gets to the speed limit, it's probably hit its max potential speed and won't go any faster. And that's where the U.S. economy is now. It's a car that's going the speed limit. But over the past few months, there's been a handful of reports coming from a bunch of different sectors like manufacturing, the labor market, consumer confidence, chief executive confidence in the economy. And what's happening is that the car is starting to slow down. So instead of going 55, now it's probably going closer to 35. And at some point when that car goes into reverse, that's when a recession happens. So what we're seeing now is an economy that's essentially taking its foot off of the gas. So the Federal Reserve lowered its forecast of growth by about 20%. Growth in U.S. gross domestic product, which is the broadest measure of economic growth, was revised downward. So all of these things are slowing the economy down. And it doesn't paint a disastrous picture at any point. The car's not going to come to a stop anytime soon. But if these trends that have been happening for the past few months continue for another 3, 6, 9 months, what you could see is a car that's essentially going 0 miles per hour. And at that point, it wouldn't take much to shift it into reverse. So is Trump getting what he wants out of the economy right now? Yes. In the next year, probably not. And there are a few big headwinds. Think of it as like a semi-trailer or in a passing lane that's just going to merge without looking and knock your car off the road. And that could be something like Brexit. That could be escalations in the trade war with China. That could be the European Union economies going into a recession or the Chinese economy going into recession. So all of these indicators you know, housing price growth has slowed. Consumer confidence is slowing. Everybody sees all of the main forecasters, so the Wall Street forecasters, the Fed forecasters, pretty much everybody but the White House forecasters see that the downside risks to the economy at this point are now starting to outweigh the upside risks.
And, of course, the big question is what will it be like during the election season?
Exactly. So the economists can't predict a recession in advance. It's usually economists say that a recession started 6 months ago by the time they announce it. So this probably won't happen in 2019. That would be my guess, whether it again, barring any unforeseen international developments. But by 2020, you might see that car slowing down to 10 or 5 miles an hour instead of maybe the 35 it's going now.
And the question is, will it matter to those people who support this president through everything?
Mm-hmm.
The man will blame someone else. He'll find someone to point a finger at, and the question is whether or not, you know, they will, his voters and his base will abandon him. And I think that certainly will not be the case. Like, you still have farmers, you still have soybean farmers that are wearing their Make America Great hats again.
Sure, but there's a lot of swing. So there's Trump's hardcore base. And then there's the people who voted for Trump, who are swing voters, for lack of a better term. If a recession does come, or if it's localized to a handful of industries like manufacturing in states like Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, New York to a certain extent, they could swing the other way. And that's incumbent upon whoever the Democratic nominee is to have a proposal that says, we're going to move, at least economically, the economy forward because Trump's not doing a good job.
Well, restoring our manufacturing economy was one of the big pushes of Trump when he was campaigning. Has that happened, or is that happening?
It's not because of any of his policies. Manufacturing follows the business cycle. Manufacturing employment has been on the decline since the 1970s. Manufacturing output is up primarily because of improved technology, automation, and productivity gains. But we're not getting those manufacturing jobs back under any Trump policies. But if you look at things like the Green New Deal, that is an actual proposal to bring back manufacturing jobs in selected industries, not the traditional ones like steel and coal.
How do you all feel about a ban on single-use plastic bags in New York State? New York State lawmakers have agreed to impose a statewide ban on most types of single-use plastic bags from retail sales. Changing a way of life for millions of New Yorkers as legislators seek to curb an unsightly and omnipresent source of litter. The plan proposed a year ago by Governor Andrew Cuomo would be the second statewide ban after California, which banned bags in 2016. Hawaii also effectively has a ban in place since all the state's counties bar such single-use bags. That from Jesse McKinley, who was Alan's guest yesterday on Capital Connection.
And not only that, we have that ban in not only California and New York now, but in Massachusetts. Little town of Great Barrington has banned it for years. And in the beginning, it was a pain in the rear because now you had to get – you pay a dime for a piece of, a bag. But the problem is that those bags don't hold up. Anyway, you get used to it. My point is you get used to it, and it means that we're setting the way for everybody else in the country and maybe the world. It's well worth doing.
My wife and I were in Chicago last year.
I'm sorry.
In Chicago, they charge 7 cents a bag.
Right.
Right? My wife...
A plastic bag?
My wife made me carry things in my pocket, vitamins in my pocket. I've never actually used my pockets, but when I was in Chicago, every pouch, everything I have, I was using... because she did not want to pay.
Going to save 7 cents.
And the worst part is we went to
is when I took the vitamins out, they weren't all in the container.
We went to the mall, and it's like, so you go pay, and they give you all of your clothes, and I'm walking out of a mall with clothes and no bag.
Did
and
you
I'm
feel
looking
comfortable?
At all the security cameras saying, people, this is a thing. I pay, you know, it's like it was really a different.
But they could have put it in a paper bag.
Right. I was going to say, you can just shift the bagging from plastic to paper, and it's not that there's not a surfeit of paper bags around.
The ban is expected to be part of the state's budget bills that are slated to be passed Monday. It has a number of carve-outs, including food takeout bags used by restaurants, bags used to wrap deli or meat counter products, and bags for bulk items. Newspaper bags would also be exempted, as would garment bags and bags sold in bulk, such as trash or recycling.
Hey, but what those doggy poop bags? Well, what about
there
them?
There you go. There you go. So, I assume that's also a carve-out.
The carve-out is for any organization that has a powerful lobbying group.
Well, and then there is some concern about the use of paper bags, that that's not good for the environment in the long haul as well.
Well, it's better though, right? It's because
it can be recycled.
It can be recycled, but it's not a 100% win for environmentalists. There's also the concern about the poor and how, I mean, every nickel, every 5 cents mm-hmm. they get charged for a bag will add up. Maybe we need to compensate or provide some provision to make sure that this doesn't adversely affect the poor more than other people.
So, obviously, environmental groups are very – we should say we're very sad that Judith isn't here to talk about this. So she's away today, and but normally I'm sure would be talking about this subject.
But Judith would look to the right, and then she would see Susan Collins' face sort of appear.
She's
mystically.
Not here to defend herself. Just stop it.
this is a great time for a WAMC tote bag.
We have them. So
the problem is you got to remember when you're getting out of the car.
Oh, Alan, that's the thing.
So keep them in your car. That's what I do.
Yeah, but then when you
get out of the car.
All right. Now, let's examine that just for a second.
Yes, play it through, Alan.
Okay. You leave it in the car. You bring it in. You fill it up
with groceries. If you remember to bring it in.
Yeah, if you remember to bring it in, you fill it up with groceries. You come home, you have to take the bag into your house, and that's where the whole thing goes wrong, because you forget to put it back in the car.
Right.
Amazon.
What? Oh, geez. Yeah, that's very
well,
popular.
Perhaps the 5 cent charge will stimulate people's memories enough that they can remember to bring it back to the car.
I do like one of our local grocery store has, if you buy the bag, the money goes to the food pantry, so that's a good idea.
And this doesn't take effect until next March, so there's plenty of time
for us to go wild in our bagging.
You know, I'm surprised there's not a subsidy for people who bring their own bags. So, you know, instead of being charged for a plastic,
using
the plastic bag, or no cost for a paper bag, you save.
That's brilliant.
Know.
Brilliant.
I'm an economist. I'm always right.
Okay, so Betsy DeVos says, hey, I got an idea. We're going to cut money to the Special Olympics. The entire budget for the Special Olympics we're going to cut. That's a way of saving money. Well, that didn't go over well. And President Trump said Thursday that he wants the federal government to continue funding the Special Olympics, which was in a reversal from his own budget proposal that eliminated the money. He made the statement on the South Lawn of the White House after his Education Secretary Betsy DeVos spent 3 days defending the proposal, most recently at a contentious Senate hearing Thursday morning. Then finally, Trump came out and said the Special Olympics will be funded. I just told my people I want to fund the Special Olympics. I've been to the Special Olympics. I think it's incredible. And I just authorized a funding.
So he pulls the rug right out from under Betsy DeVos. And we have to, the credibility is strained that he didn't know. He just found out, he said on the lawn. He just found out that this was going on.
They first heard about it on Thursday. And that others in administration were responsible for it, and they didn't tell him.
I have to say, I have no love for Betsy DeVos, that's for sure. I think she may be the worst thing to come along in a long time. But you got to really wonder what she said when she went home at night. Yeah. About his having pulled the rug out from under her.
So, you know, the total federal budget is about $4 trillion, and the funding for the Special Olympics was $17.6 million.
Correct.
So that is 0.0004%. Of all federal spending. So that's, you know, a fraction of a penny.
So what's your point?
I can't fathom how people did not consider the optics of this, that it's bound to get out, whether it's becomes part of the final budget that's passed by Congress or not, is that it's such a small percentage that there's just a mental I'm trying to figure out how to say this nicely. A lack of mental activity going on among certain people to cut such a small amount in such a high profile for such a high profile.
But maybe they did consider the optics. In other words, these are people, these Trump people, who really get great glee, obviously, out of doing what the so-called liberals in this country don't want them to do.
This is a person who, okay, so for those of us in public safety, we have been, for the last 30 years, encouraging women to come forward to report crimes that happened to them on college campuses. This is a person who comes into office and says, I feel really bad for these young men who get accused of committing these offenses. And she, in the matter of 2 years, begins to roll back, you know, what is taking us 30 years to achieve. And you think this is surprising? Yeah. This woman walks into a room and it's like, you're an evil one, right? I mean, this is she literally, that's her theme song, right? Yeah. I mean, I expect her to just like...
With garlic in her soul.
Yes, with garlic in her soul, man.
Conan O'Brien tweeted yesterday, says, look, I'm not perfect, but at least my obituary won't say in 2019 I defunded the Special Olympics.
Thank you, Conan.
Yes. All right. And finally this morning, we end with bump stocks. The Supreme Court declines to stop Trump administration's ban on bump stocks. The Supreme Court on Thursday declined to block the administration's ban, devices that effectively speed up how quickly rifles can be fired. Groups supporting gun owners and opposing firearms restrictions have sharply criticized the bump stock ban and challenged it in court, including filing two petitions seeking to delay the ban from taking effect, which it did earlier this week. Chief Justice John Roberts on Tuesday denied one such request, while Justice Sonia Sotomayor had asked for more findings in response to another. She referred that stay request to the full court, and Thursday the justices denied the petition. There were no noted dissents released by the court.
And the bump stock was the device that enabled such carnage
in the Las Vegas shooting.
It essentially makes a gun a machine gun.
Right.
But the point in some of these lawsuits is the expansion of executive power, the fact that he was able to do this through an executive order, which he, which is an interesting issue but not resolved at this point.
Pro-gun groups fighting the Trump administration's bump stock ban in court have long decried the action as government overreach and accused the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives of trying to bull through the sea change in interpretation and enforcement.
Am I right that the NRA did not weigh in on this one? That they have been silent? There were other gun advocate groups that are pursuing this.
Yeah, Gun Owners of America got involved and... But this goes to your point of like Betsy DeVos going and saying, oh, I got an idea. We'll save money by the Special Olympics. I mean, the optics of just saying, of this thing that killed all those people.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's because this thing that killed all those people happens to be something that happens every month in our country now that, you know, people have already forgotten what bump stocks are.
And really, is that what legitimate reason could there be to have a bump stock?
Yeah.
To defend people from your family and your loved ones from people coming in the house and trying to kill you, unquote.
In New York, we have a law that allows for police officers, for example, to create ghost guns and sell them without being prosecuted. You know, there's provision that allows for it.
What's a ghost gun?
Yeah,
you can take piping and other materials and drill your holes and create one, right? That which would be illegal for you and I to sell, to just hand off to anybody, you know. People are creating ghost guns, right?
And so the police lobby goes ahead and pushes this law through.
And it's a special something.
I
have a colleague south of us here who is currently trying to prosecute a person who was selling one of these weapons to a trafficker, and there is an exception. and therefore he's prohibited from moving forward in that prosecution. And it's like, this is just crazy, that the fact that this organization is so powerful that they can pass legislation that really undermine public safety, but really is offensive to common sense.
There was a an article in the it was on NPR about how as the ban goes into effect, that gun dealers around the country, were the sales were going through the roof, because they were saying, quote, this is your last chance to enjoy this unique firing experience, which allows the bump stock allows a semi-automatic rifle to fire almost as fast as an illegal machine gun.
And every time there is a mass shooting and there is an AR-15, you will see spikes in sale nationally.
Interesting.
So, yeah, 58 people killed, hundreds injured in that case. All right, we are out of time. I do want to give some time to Aaron to before we go to make a plug.
Very quickly, my bluegrass band Big Stone Gap is going to be playing at the Browns Wallumsack Tap Room this Saturday from 6:30 to 9. What a great way to celebrate the onset of spring.
You bet.
Oh, that's great.
Hot tunes and cold beer.
What time is it?
6:30 to 9.
Oh, very nice.
At the Browns Wallumsack Tap Room in Hoosick Falls.
It's going to be warm. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. You're right on the waterfall there. Gorgeous. Well, have fun.
Thank you. We will.
I may even come. I don't know.
I'll put you on the guest list.
Thank you. Oh, really? Oh, okay. Is there a cover charge? There's a cover charge.
No, there is no cover charge.
Oh, all right. Well, buy me a beer then. Judy, thank you very much for being here. Good to have you.
Always glad to be here.
Thank you very much. And David Soares, thank you for your wisdom today.
Be safe.
Mm-hmm. We appreciate it. Alan Chartok, thank you. Thank you for your valiant fight.
Back from the wars.
Back from the wars. Dust up, rest up, or dust off, rest up. That's what I was trying to say. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll be back with more show right after this.